And welcome to What the World Needs Now. This is your host, Ken Johnston, and it's a pleasure and a privilege to be with you for the next hour. I want to praise and thank God for all of our listeners, and thank you for all that you do for us here at In His Sign Catholic Radio, both your financial and prayerful support that's kept us on the air for nearly 50 years and allows us to bring you great shows like today's. Today I am going to be joined by Kristen Van Uden from the Sophia Institute. We've had Kristen on a number of times. Sophia Institute has been republishing some older works, and the authors are no longer alive and kicking, so oftentimes Kristen gets nominated to come on and talk about these great books. So, Kristen, welcome back. It's great to have you with us.
Hi, Ken. Thanks for having me back.
And two of the works we're talking about today, one is by Carol Hauslander, and the title of the book is Guilt, and the other is Evidence of Satan in the Modern World, written by Monsignor Leon Christiani. So I thought we'd start with this book called Guilt. And even before we get to the book, Kristen, it seems like Sophia is going about republishing a number of these great books. Is there anything in particular that is driving that, or is it just because a number of these books are really spot on for what's going on in the world today?
Yeah, so we're lucky that we have a pretty big back catalog of reprints that we can choose from, so we already have the rights to a lot of these titles, and it's just a matter of figuring out which ones will best resonate with the audience in any given year. So you're definitely onto something when you say that, yes, these are books that seem to have a modern relevance, and I would say especially these two, Evidence of Satan in the Modern World, of course, modern to him, he's meaning the 1950s and like mid-18th century to his contemporary time, and then Guilt, which was also written in the 1950s, are both happening at this very important pivotal time for the Church and for the world. Of course, we have the horrors of the 20th century, of the Holocaust, the Cold War, the wars, and the psychological effects and the spiritual effects that had on everyone, and both of these books deal with that in their own particular way. And as many would argue today, that has gotten better to a certain extent, but also gotten worse. We see especially just occult activity out in the open, and the field of psychology, which is what Carol Hauslander discusses, has kind of ballooned, so everyone oftentimes chooses to approach self-help through this more materialistic psychological lens, and in doing so often turns away from the spiritual. So these two books, I think, serve the purpose of making these topics that might be bouncing around in the back of our heads. We know that something is off, but we can't exactly put our finger on it, identifying the origins of a lot of the problems that the world faces today. And there are so many more that could be published. The ones that typically tend to do the best are the ones to do with exorcisms, which, I mean, is obvious. That's something that's pretty sensational and sells well. And also those specific books that talk about saints. So last year we published The Diary of Saint Gemma, which I think I might have discussed with you.
Right.
And a number of other biographies of saints, so of Saint Peter Claver, for example. So it is kind of it's a process where there's more to choose from than we have the ability to get out there, which is a good problem to have, just because there's so much in the Church's treasury, but the selection process is half the fun.
Yeah. I found it interesting that we're doing these two books in particular together, because Carol Hauslander deals with the sick psychological. She talks a lot about ego neurosis, and I think sometimes people mistake that for demonic activity, and then you have the evidence of Satan in the modern world, and you have many that, you know, including priests and bishops, that will tell you that Satan doesn't really exist, or if he does, he doesn't have near the power that we'd like to attribute it to him. And especially in looking at Monsignor Christiani's book, it seems to ebb and flow over the course of history. You know, sometimes Satan's predominant, and other times he's not. And I'm just wondering, with Carol Hauslander's book, she deals primarily with the psychological part, right?
Mm-hmm. And she does, yes.
And so, I'm sorry. So she comes up, not born into a Catholic family. They were Anglican. Her mother converts, and then has her and her sister baptized, I believe. Because of some things that went on, she left the Catholic Church, but eventually comes back. But what was interesting to me is, as a lay Catholic, and didn't go to school, I don't believe, never got a degree in psychology or psychiatry,
right.
And yet was very knowledgeable, and an awful lot of people would come to her seeking help with psychological issues, right?
Yes, she has a very interesting background. So as you mentioned, she was baptized as a Catholic as a child at the behest of her mother upon her mother's conversion. And this is one of Carol's most personal books that she's written, is her autobiography. And she calls it a rocking horse Catholic rather than a cradle Catholic, to kind of refer to that period in her life when she converted, when she was a young child, and kind of in the nursery and playing with toys, rather than as a baby being baptized. So kind of a cute way of putting it. But she eventually left the church, as you mentioned, kind of seems to just be seduced by the world and by the various intellectual currents that were sort of seeking to discredit the faith on scientific principles and intellectual principles at that time. And she returned, actually, after she had several mystical experiences. So a lot of times when people have heard of her, they'll have heard of her as a mystic. And her visions have not been approved by the church. So, of course, we, given that, almost take them with a grain of salt, or just understand that they're not official in any way. But she reports to have had a vision of the crucified Christ on the cross. And this is something that just stuck with her and communicated the truths of the faith to her in a very immediate way, more so than any of the reading that she had done was able to do. And then she also reports having visions of the Tsar of Russia when he was assassinated, and connects that to this overall chaos that the 20th century will descend into, which in this book, Guilt, she makes a lot of analysis of world figures from the psychological perspective. So very tuned in at that point. She was an artist, and sort of had a lot of odd jobs throughout her life. But what she's most well known for, in addition to her writing, is this role of sort of counselor. Not officially, as you said, she had no actual training in the field of psychology. And of course, this was a very new field at the time, still emerging, still starting to get its grounding. But she kind of crossed genres, where she would not avoid talking about God with the people who were sent to her. And oftentimes, priests would send some of their most difficult cases to Carol because they weren't making any progress. And she provided that person of a friend, but also a friend who gives the best advice and is not going to just coddle them on the one hand. She'll tell them the truth, but will also not dismiss any of their feelings on the other hand. So she definitely had a knack for this type of activity, even though it was not something she was trained in professionally. And this is important to keep in mind because at that time, the field of psychology was largely in the wake of the Freudian analysis and the Freudian field, which was very atheistic and very materialistic. So it overall reduced the human being to a set of instincts and biological urges and things like that, and pretty much dismissed the idea of the eternal soul. And she obviously knows that's not true because of her faith. So her recognition of the whole human person, including a body, a mind, and a soul, made her that much more nuanced in her analysis and her ability to help these people. And that's really the crux of this book, is to understand that oftentimes these diseases that are reduced to something biological, physiological, or mental oftentimes do have this spiritual component, and that without addressing all three of those different angles, you're not really going to be able to get to the heart of the problem.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, and especially with my background. I know we've talked before, but I do a lot of work with folks that struggle with alcoholism and addiction, and it's like the prime example of folks that's, you know, suffer not only with a physical and an emotional malady, but also that spiritual one. And oftentimes, the only solution is a spiritual one, because God's the only one that can really remove that. So, the name of the book is Guilt, and I'm guilty of not looking at it much before this morning in prepping for today's show. And as I started to read through the introduction in the beginning, it's like, wait a minute, this is what I see this every day with people that are struggling with addiction, and so many mm-hmm. of them with guilt and shame and remorse, and not often addressed, I think, in the first half of the 20th century, after the coming of Alcoholics Anonymous and Carl Jung and some of these other psychologists that were willing to accept that there might be a spiritual side of this, that you know, only addressing the mental, the emotional, the physical part of it clearly wasn't enough.
Right. Yeah, so in this book, she makes a very bold statement, and this is kind of her recurring thesis throughout the book, that all what she refers to as neuroses, or specifically ego neuroses, can be boiled down to an unresolved, unmoored feeling of guilt. And, of course, when we think of guilt from the Catholic perspective, we know that it is a feeling that actually serves a purpose, right? When we feel guilt, that's the twinge of our conscience speaking up, and it's to point out to the fact to us that we have committed a sin and that we need to go to confession to have the sin expiated, do penance, and amend our lives. So guilt does have a purpose, but Carol Houselander's point is that when we are not able to properly expiate our guilt through the officially approved channels of the church, so through going to confession and through even recognizing that sin is a thing or is something to be contended with, then that unresolved guilt doesn't go away. No matter how much you try to stuff it down, it will fester in your soul, and it will come out in various and sundry different ways. And so she argues that basically any sort of condition can have, and not always, but can have this unresolved guilt at its roots. So she lists off a whole laundry list of them in one of her chapters, Mechanisms of Escape. So hypochondriac, for example, she considers to be a neurosis of guilt. The anxiety, many different things, even psychosomatic issues, so things that will manifest in the body rather than just a purely psychical issue. And she refers to this inability to look guilt in the face and to properly deal with it as a mechanism of escape, which is true. And I think in today's culture, that is especially apparent, where we see that this dictatorship of tolerance is really not tolerant, ironically, but also it means that if something is wrong, so certain aberrant lifestyles, for example, if something is considered wrong, but you're not allowed to call it that, you have to overcompensate and have this really... really identifying with that sin and making it something that is more in the front of your life than sin should be, and this glorifying of sin rather than absolving it. So when things are not considered sin, it doesn't make them not sin, but it does mean that there's no way to actually get rid of the knowledge that you have sinned or the feeling of guilt, and so it will stay inside. And so it's a very interesting framework to look at the world through. And the examples that she gives, and she has a whole section at the end of the book of case studies, she interestingly talks about this on a collective level. So she uses this thesis as kind of an explanation for the Holocaust, for example. She profiles a woman who became a guard at one of the concentration camps and just displayed this extreme sadism and brutality towards the people imprisoned there that really you could not have guessed would have come from this person in her previous life. She had just led a very meek and unassuming life until she was given the ability to be brutal like this. And Carol Houselander argues that this came from some sort of unresolved guilt in her past, and can't remember exactly what she pinpointed as that turning point where she accumulated this guilt. But She believes that one of the main mechanisms of escape is this identification with a collective ideology and scapegoating others in order to relieve or alleviate one's own feelings of guilt. So in our modern discourse, that's very interesting, thinking of the political ramifications of that. But certainly thinking back to mid-century when she was writing, it's interesting not only on the individual level, but also on the societal, how this can really spiral out of control when it's not addressed at the individual level.
No, I couldn't agree more. And you mentioned that we as Catholics should know how to address guilt, and that guilt is it's not a bad thing, because as you said, it should, when we feel that twinge of guilt, acknowledge it and try to figure out where it's coming from. And so many people, especially those that they come, there may have been lapsed Catholics and come back to the church, one of the first things they talk about oftentimes is that Catholic guilt, like it's a Catholic thing.
Right.
That only the Catholic feel guilty, and maybe it's because we were, you know, raised in such a way that we should know right from wrong, that, you know, sin is still a sin, and, you know, but they apply that Catholic adjective to it, where that's the way God has created us, and especially in this day and age, as you know, so thoughtfully said, that, you know, all these people today are walking around with this guilt, and just because we tolerate it and say that, you know, what you're doing is, you know, supposedly we're going to say it's okay, that doesn't remove the guilt that the person feels for participating in a heinous act or a particular behavior. That the guilt that they feel should tell them that maybe they need to make a change in their lives, but instead of making the change, we tell them, no, keep doing what you're doing. You know, cut up your body, do whatever it is you need to do that you think is going to make you feel better, and in the end you still have all the same guilt, the same everything else. It's just now your body's different, or you're still in a in a relationship that's not going to, that will never fix the problem. But that until we acknowledge that the guilt comes from that conscience that God gave us, that not that they're forever lost, but it's going to be real hard for them to ever come to terms with that guilt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a great point, and that we're often told that pointing out a sin, and, you know, people shouldn't go around like constantly pointing out sin, but we're told that this tolerance is charitable. But actually, when you think in terms of the four last things and how God sees the world, it's not charitable to lie to people about sin, or to claim sin doesn't exist or something isn't a sin when it really is, because that's not charitable in the long term. The only thing that's really charitable is truth spoken with charity, and not changing the truth, because the truth cannot change. Only our perception of the truth can change. So when people are lied to, the only thing that will suffer is the person doing the lying and the person being lied to, because they, again, no matter how much you try to ignore sin, it still exists, and our sensitivity to it is always there because we were created by God. So that is a function that we shouldn't ever try to stifle in ourselves, and we should develop the conscience. And it's something that's, as she talked about, really develops throughout your entire life.
Yeah, you mentioned in part four of the book, that is called Illustrations, but it's probably a dozen folks or so that Carol Hauslander talks about individually, and I think at least I don't recognize a lot of the names, but one that everybody would recognize would be the little flower, Therese Martin. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't thought about it in terms of guilt until I noticed that she was written about in this book. But I think most people that are familiar with her know about the suffering that she encountered, but maybe not the suffering as a young person, and then at least I didn't realize it with her father.
Right. Yeah, everyone, when they think of Saint Therese, recognizes her physical suffering, so how she died quite young of illness and spent those last years of her life writing down her memoirs, but she also went through a great deal of psychological suffering. Her mother died at a young age, and then she had been kind of the baby of the family and was oftentimes very spoiled by her older sisters and her father. And then there was this one point where her father was kind of fed up and wanted her to grow up. And she went through this ego death, as Carol Hauslander really highlights, where she had to learn how to die to self and to get through those feelings of embarrassment and embrace this humility that would characterize the rest of her life. And of course, this comes out in the most obvious way through her path of the little way, where no task was too small or too insignificant for her if it was done with love of God. And of course, that could be turned into graces for souls. So Carol Houselander gives us several examples of saints who, instead of letting their ego rule them in this way and causing all sorts of ego neuroses, they instead embrace humility, where they subordinate their ego to reality and to God's will, and how that is a much healthier way of dealing with these feelings that can arise from an overemphasis on the ego, including unresolved guilt. And I like how this chapter or this section is kind of haphazard in the way it's structured at first glance, but then you take a closer look and you see that she intersperses the stories of the saints, who are success stories when it comes to dealing with guilt, with the stories of those who can be considered to have failed with properly integrating guilt, and the various ways of that they acted out instead of just surrendering to God. So a few of these, like some well-known authors such as Franz Kafka, who himself described in one of his writings that he possessed an infinite sense of guilt. And reading his writings, it's very obvious this feeling of self-hatred comes from, in her estimation, that unresolved guilt, and what he's just very well known for, such as his story, The Metamorphosis, where he literally is transformed into a bug in the story because that's how he feels about himself inside. And she writes how this is a coping mechanism for the unresolved guilt that he wasn't able to express in another way. Also, a case study in this section, she has a few, actually, of murderers or serial killers. So we talked about the Holocaust guard already, but there's another one, forgetting his name, Peter something. He was somebody I had not heard of before, but the early 20th century serial killer. And she discusses his childhood and the role that this guilt turning in on himself and turning into a self-hatred played. And then he had nothing to do with those feelings as he grew up. And so his methodology of acting out was through crime. She has a very interesting theory of crime. She believes that crime is actually the cry of a repressed conscience, because the person is guilty for some primordial sin, even just original sin. They're not baptized. And they don't know how to get rid of that feeling. All they know is that they feel that they have to be punished somehow. So in her theory, some people turn to crime just so that they can be caught, captured, and punished for something, hoping that that feeling of guilt that preceded the crime will be washed away, feeling that justice has been served after they serve their sentence. And of course, that doesn't work because, sin is something that is eternal and only is wiped away by Jesus, and his sacrifice for us can only be dealt with in the supernatural realm, not by serving any sort of earthly penance like that. And that was something that was just really fascinating to me. I don't know if that works in every case, but it certainly does provide an explanation, because of course this is all subconscious. She doesn't think that anyone is really thinking through this in rational terms, but how the mind has to cope with this in some way. And the human soul really yearns for justice in this way, even if it's justice against itself. It, because justice is an attribute of God, we wish for that and we hope to approach that. And so obviously she concludes the book with showing us that we can approach that only truly through the expiation that Christ made on the cross, and that gift of free grace. And the only way to really approach that is humility.
Amen. We've got just a minute or two before we're going to go to the break. Our guest today is Kristen Van Uden, and we're going to talk about two books today. The one we've been talking about in this segment is entitled Guilt, originally written by Carol Houselander, originally published back in the late 1950s. And, really, is right on the mark for what we're seeing going on, and just what you were describing there about, you know, crime and, you know, is it repressed guilt that people are acting out on? You think about some of the things that are going on today, and you have to wonder if maybe this might be the root of it. The book that we're discussing, Guilt, can be picked up at Sophia's website, sophiainstitute.com, here locally in the Philadelphia market. You can go to the St. Jude shop, the Catholic shop, and they should have it on hand. If they don't, they can always get it for you very quickly and get it into your hands. So any concluding comments on guilt before we take our break, Kristen?
I would say this is such an introspective book, and it pairs really well with something like Rooting Out Hidden Faults, which I believe we talked about last year, which is a guide to making an examination of conscience before confession. So I think you'll learn a lot about yourself reading this book, not only about the world around you, but about ways your brain operates that you might not even be aware of.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward. It probably wasn't one that I was going to read all the way through, but after having looked at it and the discussion we had, I think it's like right on the mark for a number of the things that I'm involved in. So I'm looking forward to going through the rest of it. Yeah. So,
yeah.
All right, we're going to go ahead and take a short break. Kristen's going to stick with us in the second half, and we're going to talk about Evidence of Satan in the Modern World, written by Monsignor Leon Christiani. When we come back, don't go away.
Have you ever heard of seed faith, the biblical law of sowing and reaping? Many people fail when it comes to faith for finances because they haven't planted any seed. Any farmer knows that if you want a good crop, you have to first sow the seed. The Bible speaks about seed right from the beginning in Genesis, and it's brought up all throughout the Scriptures. In the second book of Corinthians, we are told that whoever sows sparingly will also reap sparingly, but whoever sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. Why not consider sowing your financial seed into In His Sign Catholic Radio, a ministry with a 30-year history? You should sow your financial seed into a ministry that produces good fruit. Luke tells us at chapter 6, verse 44, every tree is known by its fruit. You should sow your financial seeds where you're fed, be it here, your local parish, or other worthy ministries. Please prayerfully consider joining our monthly circle of family and friends by partnering with us financially each month. All donations are completely tax deductible and go directly to our daily expenses, like the purchase of radio airtime and keeping the lights on. Kathleen McCarthy and all of the staff at In His Sign, except Kathleen's administrator, donate all of their time and talent on a volunteer basis at no expense to the ministry. Donations to In His Sign Catholic Radio may be sent to 136 Garrett Avenue, Rosemont, PA 19010. Or you can donate securely at inhissign.com. Remember, without your prayers and financial support, our mission voice will be silenced.
And welcome back to What the World Needs Now. This is your host, Ken Johnston. Again, I want to praise and thank God for all of our listeners, and thank you for all that you do for us here at In His Sign. It allows me to be here on Wednesdays and do what I do, and Kathleen to be here on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and the other broadcasters Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. We are here Monday through Friday, 4 to 6 p.m. on 800 a.m. and over our website at inhissign.com. Our guest today is Kristen Van Uden. We've a frequent guest to talk about books that Sophia Institute is republishing, written by authors that are no longer with us. And many of these titles are perfect for these times, even though they were written sometimes in the first half of the last century. So thanks again, Kristen, for joining us, especially for the whole hour. I know you're busy, and I think the conversations are beneficial in not only selling books, but to get word out there about these things that are going on in these times.
Course. Thanks for having me.
Yep. The second book we're talking about today is Evidence of Satan in the Modern World, written by Monsignor Leon Christiani. I had taken down some notes that he was a Frenchman, I believe, born in 1879 and died in 1971. This particular book was first published in French in 1959. And I think it's perfect for everything else that's going on in the world today. There's been a number of books, even movies now. I saw Nefarious a couple of weekends ago, which I highly recommend for anyone that's not seen it yet. I'm not sure if it's still in theaters, but if it is, you need to see Nefarious. The other one that's out there, The Pope's Exorcist, maybe not so much. I've read some not so great reviews from people in the Catholic world who I listen to. So, but there's been a number of books that have come out over the past couple of years, and this one in particular, I think is so much needed. I mentioned when we first got started with guilt that there's this ebb and flow of the amount of satanic activity, and whether or not people actually even believe that Satan exists or has an impact on the world today. And I think especially in this particular book that Monsignor Christiani lays it out pretty well about over the course of history how we've seen that kind of ebb and flow, beginning of course with Jesus and the temptation.
Definitely. And even self-proclaimed Satanists today oftentimes claim that they don't believe in Satan, they don't believe in the supernatural whatsoever, that it's a purely just prideful movement where they basically take Satan as their inspiration for being the first rebel and to refuse the authority of God. So the skeptics are among us, and they were even in the 1950s. So the audience of this book is really those who believe either that Satan is not active in the modern world, and again, from modern, he means basically French Revolution to the 1950s when he was writing, and also so to convince those outside of the church of the existence of the supernatural altogether, and then hopefully use that to bring them into the church, but also to remind Catholics that we can never be really, you know, just sitting back and relaxing. Like, we always have to be prepared and engaging in the spiritual warfare and making sure that we're very fastidious about not sinning and all of that, because these very extraordinary interferences from the demonic were happening in his time. And he gives a lot of really fascinating examples, and most of these I had not heard of before.
No, I was the same way. This one I spent a little bit more time with ahead of time. Mm-hmm. Like, I had no idea how much Luther and Calvin, especially Luther, would talk about Satan and supposedly, you know, his supposed battles and what have you, that he talked far more about Satan than any Catholic priest that I know of.
Yeah, that part was fascinating to me. And Monsignor makes the point that Luther almost attributes to Satan more power than he actually has. And that he thinks might actually be at the root of a lot of Luther's errors, is that he lacks this trust in God. And of course, we know that Luther was also plagued with scrupulosity. And so he had this great fear of Satan that he used to kind of take that fear and then write that into his theological positions, which were wrong. Monsignor describes it as an exaggeration of Satan's actual power and, again, a mistrust in God and that God holds the power at the end of the day. And Luther did admit to having seen demons. He also, I thought this part was kind of funny, said that he thinks monkeys are demons, like lesser demons that have taken on like a physical form, which is like very odd. And of course, when we think about, especially Calvinists, which of course a different branch of Protestantism, but also makes a very similar exaggeration of the devil's power. Think of the Puritans, for example, and believing that they would see Satan in the woods, young Goodman Brown, the Salem witch trials, and that whole phenomenon in New England, this obsession with the demonic to the point where they really don't believe in God's will, almost. And, of course, that goes hand in hand with the idea of predestination, that some people are just marked for Satan without anything that we can do about it. So it's interesting to read the intellectual underpinning of a lot of these erroneous Protestant ideas actually come from this kind of mischaracterization in the founder's own life about the role of Satan.
Yeah, and to your point, one of the quotes that I jotted down here from the introduction of the book, Monsignor writes, "The devil can do nothing against us without our own will. His force comes from our consent and his weakness from our resistance." And, I mean, there's just a prolific amount of content available these days, whether it's Monsignor Rossetti, Father Blunt, the Pope's Exorcist, and Father Amorth, who the movie's about. Again, not that I recommend it, but there seems to be an awful lot of discussion these days about the amount of demonic activity and how difficult it is in many of these cases to drive out demons, but that they're there, that this demonic activity still happens. But we have to take solace in the fact, like the Monsignor writes that I mentioned, that the devil can't do anything to us unless we allow it. And the point you were making about Luther and Calvin is that Satan can't do anything without Jesus' permission either. And so to read in the beginning and how often Jesus had called Satan the prince of the world or the ruler of the world, a gospel the other day at daily mass, you know, that he's been the prince of the world from its foundation. And that I found that difficult at first when I looked at it. You know, how could God ever allow Satan to rule the world? But I guess he's allowing it for whatever purpose it's going to serve until he comes again, in whatever way, shape, or form that happens, that Satan will finally be vanquished. But the amount of leeway Satan has, but again, only as far as Jesus permits it, right?
Right. And I found one chapter particularly helpful and encouraging in that vein, which is the one about St. John Marie Vianney and his deals with the devil, because this chapter really shows how God allows this demonic activity sometimes to bring about a greater good or to serve as the means of sanctification of one or several people. So St. John Vianney was, as we know, just a parish priest in the town of Ars, and he would spend up to 16 hours in the confessional some days. And he often was attacked physically at night, just like Padre Pio, just like St. Gemma, and some other modern saints, by demons. And they would oftentimes take the form of kind of like a haunting. So he wouldn't see something, but the windows would open and he would hear laughter and things like that. Nobody believed him at first. The other priests thought he was crazy. And then he had one of the local townspeople stay in the rectory one night, and they experienced the same exact thing. So after that, people started to catch on, and he was able to confirm, yes, this is not all in my head. And from that point forward, he was actually encouraged, because he knew God was allowing this and that there was some sort of prayerful outcome he was looking for. And he began to realize that after particularly bad nights of bouts of attacks, the next day he would get to the confessional and there would be this huge long line, oftentimes of people who had been away from the church for years or who had walked miles to be there in the morning, and they would make their good confessions and return to the church and begin living again as pious Catholics. And he always referred to them as big fish. And whenever he would have a lot of attacks at night, he said, "Oh, I know the big fish are coming tomorrow." And then he would later call them prisoners of grace after they had been liberated from sin. So he took a very positive outlook on it. He also kind of, to counter Luther's fear, the saints always have this, not indifference, but just confidence against Satan. So I think it's St. Teresa of Avila who would say, "Oh, you again," whenever she was being tempted, in this dismissive way where, like, she's like, "Okay, I know who's in charge." And then St. John Vianney was similar, where he actually had a nickname for the demon that would assault him. He called it the Grappin, which is the French word for pitchfork. So he was familiar with these temptations and attacks, and he was able to take this sort of humorous way of dealing with it. But then he also understood the great graces that could come from it. So he really provides this key example of somebody who integrated these experiences very well and then just knew to give glory to God through them.
Yeah, one of the other things that and it's interesting you mentioned the big fish, my good friend Father McKay, we always talk about the big fish whenever the ministry, you know, it seems like the ministry is getting attacked for whatever reason, and the first response is just to say a big fish must be coming, which means, you know, maybe there'll be somebody reverting back to the faith. Maybe it'll be a much needed donation at just the right time. But that often, like you said, that, and I know he gets it from St. John Vianney, that, you know, and I think it applies to all of us when we're facing struggles in our life and when we feel like we're being attacked, to know that we need to hang in there, ask for God's grace, and that something good is going to come as a result of it. And, you know, this even goes back to when we were talking about guilt and Carol Hauslander. I think that there, without the Catholic faith, suffering really has no meaning. And when we do have the faith and we look at the people that have suffered over the centuries and those that persevered, the beautiful things that came as a result of that suffering can only be explained by a belief in God. You know, we may wonder how a loving, all-merciful God could possibly allow these things to happen, but they only happen in order to bring about a greater good. But one of the... I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm so glad Monsignor starts the book with this inspiring story, too, because some of the other ones can become really, truly scary, some of these stories, but he kind of anchors us in that strong foundation of the Curia d'Ars.
Yeah, as he's going through the history in the introduction, one of the other things I found interesting, that I didn't realize how many people were actually killed or whatever label you want to put on it for witchcraft. And it's just the number of people in various countries. Like, I think sometimes because we live here in the United States and, you know, we talk about the Salem witch trials, but these have been going on for a couple centuries before that. And all over in Europe, and I had no idea that there was that many. I think in the one just in Luxembourg alone, it was 30,000, 50,000 between Germany, France, and Belgium, and I think Salem paled in comparison to what was actually going on in Europe at the time.
Right. Yeah, that part was interesting because he makes this point about exaggeration and how oftentimes these trials were an example of the exaggeration, especially after Luther's time, and his theology was kind of leading the charge on that. But also that, yes, witchcraft is a thing, it's real, and he has some modern examples even of people who got involved in the occult and had experienced possession because of that. But he again just uses that word, he calls it deplorable exaggeration, and one text that he cites in that section is called The Hammer of Witches, written by two German Dominicans, actually, so these were Catholics at the time, and he just kind of excoriates the theology in that book because it's almost a precursor to the exaggerations that he discusses with Luther. So he discusses that any thought that's really dominated by fear of Satan can only lead to bad outcomes, even here, just in this life.
Yeah. I'm just thinking of the number of times that we've mentioned Satan in the last 20 minutes, and there's people that won't even whisper his name for fear of bringing him about. But again, we need to not necessarily invite him in, but partake in activities that would open the door to allow Satan or the demons to come in, whether it's through the occult or the Ouija board, or I never knew what Ouija meant until I saw Nefarious, and it's yes in French and German together. You know, we and ya. Yes, yeah, come on in. You know, so it's, you know, we have to avail ourselves. Now, granted, sometimes we don't know that we're actually making the invitation. It may seem like what we're doing is innocent enough, but to open ourselves up. But at the same time, he doesn't have the power that God and especially that Jesus Christ has in order to help us in that battle. So I have,
exactly. And I think one of the really interesting things about this book is how Monsignor shows that the demons that manifest in the stories that he talks about are often like behaving like spoiled brats. They act like children. They're very, you know, they lash out and they're just rude, but also just whiny and childish in that way. And they always have this sort of trying to one-up each other and this competition. It's like, you know, reading the Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis. There's no love lost between the demons. Anything that, any sort of fraternity they have is all just based in a hatred. But I'll come back around to have that relevant in the next story I just wanted to cover, which is his treatment of what happened at Lourdes in the year after Bernadette's visions, where Monsignor discusses this really fascinating phenomenon that I had never heard of, which is that after St. Bernadette's true visions of Our Lady ended, there was a proliferation of false demonic visions in Lourdes, either at the grotto, in the surrounding village, on the streets, in the surrounding towns, hundreds of them. And these visions ultimately served a purpose. It was the devil's attempt to discredit St. Bernadette and to discredit the dogma of the Immaculate Conception, which of course Our Lady revealed herself as, and to just draw people away from the miraculous waters too. And so these false visions would appear. Sometimes they would try to look like Jesus and Mary. Sometimes they would just be an attempt at looking at, like Our Lady. Sometimes the whole Holy Family wearing black shoes, which is always a bad sign, like, and then sometimes just as shadows or lights. And one time, a visionary who flattered themselves that they were having a vision from God was in this conversation with this apparition, which was a demon, and the demon was insulting the surrounding town, saying, "Oh, Osen, only riffraff lids there," or "it's better than Lourdes," and kind of setting up this very childish competition between the visionaries. So when the bishop and the local priest went to investigate all of these happenings, that was a sign that it wasn't from God, because a true apparition would never be that petty, but that is a characteristic of a demon, because they're just so unhappy and miserable. And so, luckily, none of these was ever convincing enough that it would have compromised St. Bernadette's position or her message, although they did try. And interestingly, years later, when these individuals who had seen the visions were tracked down, many of them could not remember what they saw. They only reported having seen a shadow of some sort and not even having seen what they claimed to have seen at the time. So that part was encouraging as well, because when you talked about the will and how our will has to really be engaged in order to sustain serious damage in that way, these individuals, many of them were just naive. Some of them were looking for attention and to get a leg up. And some of them just were truly caught up in the hysteria of seeing these false visions. But many of them just returned to living good Catholic lives after that, frequented the sacraments, and were not affected by it later in their lives. So it just goes to show that even though they were accessories of the devil's intentions at Lourdes, his plans were confounded, because Saint Bernadette went on and was canonized, of course, and it continues to be a pilgrimage site. But also, even these people who he was using to his own means, or as his own means, they themselves, because they didn't buy into it, they returned to the sacraments, and then they listened to their spiritual directors. They were not affected for a lifelong, even though they had literally seen a demon in their youth.
Well, I think I would remember it and be permanently impacted. But it's good to know that we're not, you know, and that's the beauty of having our faith in the sacraments, and the power that Jesus Christ has over Satan. Again, our guest today is Kristen Van Uden, and we talked about two different books: "Guilt" by Carol Haslander, and "Evidence of Satan in the Modern World" by Monsignor Leon Christiani. These were books that were published in the middle of the last century, and the 1950s or so, and republished recently by Sophia Institute, available at sophiainstitute.com, locally here at the St. Jude Shop. And we've got just about 5 minutes left, Kristen, and before we let you go, I had asked you before we came on, you know, what's your other role besides speaking for the deceased authors of these books? And you had mentioned Catholic Exchange. And I've seen it from time to time, and brought it up. So, it more or less a blog from various Catholic writers that you help edit these days.
Yes, so I'm editor of Catholic Exchange, which is under the Sophia Institute umbrella, and it's a daily resource for 3 articles a day in topics of prayer, spirituality, church history, sometimes just, you know, saints' feast days, things like that. So. Book reviews, for example. Yeah, I really recommend it as a resource. It's not the hard-hitting news, so it's not stuff that is really headline-making, but it's just that source for continued spiritual development and learning about all the very many facets of the church and traditions you might not have heard of before, and advice. A lot of priests will have their homilies posted there, so scripture reflections, things like that. So that is my other main job here. I edit that. We also produce a podcast weekly. So speaking of Lourdes, I just interviewed an author who wrote about modern miracles at Lourdes. So she actually interviewed about 20 people who have experienced healings within the past, 10, 20, 30 years from Lourdes. So miracles continue to be poured out there. I also interviewed somebody who writes about Marie Antoinette and how she truly has been maligned in history and was actually a very devout Catholic queen. So that was a very interesting perspective. And so, yeah, that's at CatholicExchange.com. The other big thing that I'm working on is that I'm actually working on my own manuscript, another interview type of book. So I interviewed several individuals who survived communism, who were Catholic and kept the faith throughout persecution in various communist countries. Some of them went to jail for years. Others were part of the underground churches. So just scrambling to finish that up, but that's been really exciting as well.
Yeah, well, we may need that one sooner rather than later if things continue down the path that we're on right now. And I took a quick look at the podcast page. So your Modern Miracles at Lourdes was Marlene Watkins.
And, that's right.
Yeah, and of course she had the book that was published by Sophia, and I actually had her on 2 weeks ago.
And, oh, nice.
Yeah, and it was one of the great odd, is that odd or is that God moments for us. I directed a retreat, and it was only going to be 3 days after that, and she overnighted me a bunch of bottles of Lourdes water, and we were able to do a healing ceremony on the retreat.
No way.
Yeah, and there were 2 miracles that occurred on the weekend. Some people may not have looked at them that way, but you know the strength of and the beauty of our Catholic faith and all that it entails. And mm-hmm. of course, not every you don't have to the you know things like Lourdes are not dogma. Now, the Immaculate Conception would be dogma, but believing in the miracles and those types of things, you can take it or leave it if you want, but to ignore it and to see these great things that happen even up till this day, you can't help but believe that God's alive and well and eventually going to conquer all.
Yeah.
In the meantime,
definitely.
In the meantime, we got to fight the good fight. Got just a minute left. Anything you want to leave with our listeners before I have to let you go, Kristen?
I think that's it. Stay tuned. We'll have a lot of good books coming this summer. My book will be coming out this November, and lots of mix between some good reprints. So maybe you'll hear from me again in the next couple months and some more contemporary authors. So always great talking with you because I love to be able to talk in depth about the books.
I love having you, Kristen, and we'll keep an eye out for the emails that come from Sophia for all the books that get published. Thanks again for coming on, for being with us for the whole hour. Can't thank you enough, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you. God bless.
You too. Bye-bye now. So, books for these times with all the craziness that's going on in this world. I want to thank you for whatever part of the 2 hours you could be with us today. I think it's more important now than ever as things continue to get more chaotic. But we have hope in our Lord, and especially in this time of year as we prepare for Ascension Thursday tomorrow and, of course, Pentecost next week. We know that God's alive and well and with us all the time. We just need to turn to Him. So thank you for being with us today, and I look forward to being with you again next Wednesday. Till then, I pray that God will hold you in the palm of His hand. Take care, and God bless.